Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. On today's episodes, we are hitting up both the coasts, kicking it off in New York with Chef Dan Kluger, who owns many of spots, including Grey Wind, Loring Place, Washington Squares. We chat about his adventures into the culinary world, cutting his teeth in some of the most classic New York City restaurants, and how he opened his new spot in the Hudson Yards. It is a great chat and a real trip down memory lane to New York City. And then we head to L.A., back to Dangerbird Records Studio in Silver Lake, where we hang out with Matt Costa, who was chatting about his 15-year career and gives us a live studio performance from his then newest LP, Santa Rosa Fangs. It was his first full-length album in 5 years. He tells the tale of a young woman named Sharon and her two brothers, Richie and Tony, and their coming of age in California. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
She's going out tonight. See her aquarium friends. Amongst the buffoons and the bogarts. She's strung out again. She knows now what she does. She knows not how she feels. She don't know if she's living or dying. Her bucket's full of pills. And she's colder than the coast of Maine. Sharon on a snowy winter's day. Sharon, she'll cut you like she cut me. Sharon, it's a new region on the sea. Sharon, 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 Sharon. Sharon, 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 Sharon. You know I've seen you make arrangements with all the lawyers at the bar. I know you're going through those changes. Yeah, I know you're going through those changes. And I've seen you going through those changes. Gone, gone, gone. And still your daddy pays your rent. She knows now what she does. She knows not how she feels. She don't know if she's living or dying. Her bucket's full of pills. And she's colder than the coast of Maine. Sharon, on a snowy winter's day. Sharon, she cut you like she cut me. Sharon, and send you raging on my sea. Sharon, 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 Sharon. Sharon, 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 Sharon.
Chef, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thanks so much for making the time. Really appreciate you sitting down with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I lived in New York for 10 years, and I felt like every time I met a lifelong New Yorker, you could pretty much tell immediately. And I know that you're one. What is that vibe that you give off, that all of you give off, that just says like, I've been here since my day one?
I have no idea. And it's funny because like, I'll talk to people, they're like amazed that I'm born and raised in the sense like, wow, you know, I don't know anybody that's born and raised. Like they're so surprised by that. And for me, I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm around a lot of people on a daily basis that are not born and raised New Yorkers, but I don't know. Just never really throws me off, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, grew up on the Upper West Side, had parents who were into food, and your parents did something similar that my parents did, which was like every night until I started, you know, working in like a pizza place, something like that. It was like, sit down at the table, have a dinner. Yep. I know you're a dad now, and obviously you work in hospitality. Did that, like, let's sit down for dinner, enjoy each other's time, have a big impact, a lasting impact on you?
Yeah, I think it instilled that a home-cooked meal mentality, which is something that I certainly am not very able to do for my family, but when I do, it's sure. It's important to me. But I think it was more the sort of fact of like, you know, so to speak, breaking bread, right? Like we sat down at the table and it was a chance to get together. And so I think that's why, while, you know, being in a restaurant is completely opposite than eating at home, I think that's why, you know, just dining and food being this icebreaker and this opportunity for people to gather just became part of my life from the onset.
I mean, it's such a nice feeling, especially being in New York, to get a home cooked meal. I don't know when I lived there how much I cooked. It wasn't a lot. It probably would be more now. I think the idea of eating out all the time has just shifted so much in the city. Especially like when you can like walk around and go to the different neighborhoods. Yeah. What do you remember when you were of age, when you could finally start walking around the city? Where were you going? Where were you eating? Like, what were you listening to as a teenager, as a kid?
I mean, again, I think interestingly, for as much as this has become my career, dining out was not our thing. Going down to Chinatown and picking up things to make dinner, that was more a thing. I certainly could probably count on one hand the number of like nice meals we had out. Most of it was pizza takeout or Chinese, going to a Chinese restaurant. There was no obviously no DoorDash or Uber Eats or any of that kind of stuff. And takeout was not really a thing that my parents promoted in any way. Again, pizza is probably the only thing that was ever takeout that I can remember. And then Chinese food was always going to our local Chinese restaurant. And, interestingly, my father was very, very adamant about, you know, if there was something seasonal, if it was asparagus season or you know, soft shell crab season or whatever, like that was his thing to go for. And so in a weird way, that taught me about seasonality, because I kind of was like, well, why can't you just always get that? So I think that was, you know, a big part of growing up in terms of eating out and just the my food culture. I think, you know, if I was out with friends or you know, walking down the street, I often would stop and get either a warm H&H bagel and eat that as I was walking down the street, or, you know, the ubiquitous slice of pizza folded and walking down the street. So those were probably my snacks and my earliest, you know, food memories.
So was your dad taking you to the green markets? Was he taking you around? I mean, there weren't really green markets, not like it is today, but the seasonality was just more of just like the local grocer, what they had in.
Yeah. I mean, it was, like I said, going to Chinatown, going to Fairway, Citarella's to pick up things for dinner.
Okay. Got it.
If we were out in the country, like staying with friends or something, there was always the roadside stand.
Sure. Sure.
But I didn't understand what any of that stuff meant at that point in time. I remember as a young kid, really young, probably too young to have seen it, but my parents like had joined some kind of co-op. I don't remember the details of it, but they took me somewhere where they were slaughtering lamb. And somehow or another, I wandered off and watched them slaughter the lamb. And so again, it was like, you know, little New York City apartment, bringing home lamb and beef and whatever else. And it was like packaging up and putting in the freezer, and that would get you for a while. And that was like part of their mentality. It wasn't going to a supermarket every day. There was no Whole Foods. It was much more, you know, minute and smaller, and this sort of mentality of getting something and you know, making it last, whether it was buying tomatoes at the end of the season and making tomato sauce, or my mom loved to make jam and, you know, peak fruit season. Mm-hmm. So things like that I think slowly just kind of in a weird way put those things in my mind without realizing that they were there.
When did you start to realize it was there? When did things flip, and when did restaurants, because look, I grew up the same way. Like, we cooked, it was pizza, it was Chinese food. Like, I didn't really think about restaurants as having a spot for me until my 20s, you know, until a bit later in life. So what was it that you started to realize, like, oh, you could go out and cook food and you could take what you did at home and do it on a public scale?
I went to college not knowing what I was going to do, and I had some different ideas, and long story short, thought I was going to do physical therapy. And in order to do that, they suggested a bunch of prerequisites, and some of those were nutrition and food science, and things like that. And I kind of got really intrigued by them. And again, being in the kitchen, not that I was like cooking for a living, but being in the kitchen was somewhat normal to me. I grew up being in the kitchen,
right?
Probably around, as early as probably around 10 or 11, our friends had opened a bakery on the Upper West Side, and my father loved to bake. So on Saturdays, he would go and kind of volunteer and help out, and I would go a lot of times. And so I learned how to make, you know, muffins and croissants and other things at a young age, and I enjoyed being in the kitchen. And then probably around 14, 15, 16, whenever I guess I could legally work, I think I spent some summers working there. So again, being in the kitchen was kind of normal. I started taking these classes. I was kind of intrigued by them. Roundabout way, met Danny Meyer, ended up doing an internship at Union Square Cafe back in 1995. That was front of the house, back of the house, a little bit of everything. And that just kind of opened the doors. I saw this, like, you know, it was literally like this eureka moment of the doors open and you're like in a whole nother world, and everything is this little moment of excitement. So, went back to school. I was a fifth year student, so I was going into my fourth year after my internship and was really excited by the idea of restaurants and food. And kind of went full steam ahead with this nutrition, restaurant management, kind of made up degree. And then my fifth year, that was my fourth year. And so my fifth year, I was pretty much finishing up, and I was kind of working as a teacher's assistant with some of the cooking classes and other things. And really was like, wow, this is of interest to me. Went back to Union Square Cafe in the summer, got a job in the front of the house, and was working in the kitchen on my days off. Not expecting that would be my route or my passion, but just wanted to understand it, wanted to know about it if I was going to do restaurants in some form or another. And they offered me a job in the kitchen, and I've been there since.
I mean, that's incredible to find your way into that, and not just any restaurants, but, you know, Danny Meyer, and I know you worked for Tom Colicchio. So, you know, this era of food, late 90s, early 2000s, was definitely, I don't want to say the end of an era, but definitely part of the old school era system, where there was some great tutelage, but then also some practices that, let's say, have been retired, at least looked upon differently now in the hindsight. What was it like during that time to cook, both, you know, the good and the maybe methods of a time gone by?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you're alluding to is sort of our labor laws today and how much it's affected the ability to stage and that kind of thing. I mean, I spent a week at Oriole. I spent a few days somewhere else. I can't remember where at this point in time, but then ended up at Union Square, you know, kind of saying, okay, I'm gonna really commit to this. And that was really because I was spending my days off hanging out in the kitchen. It wasn't
right.
There was no money at the beginning of it. It was like, hey, I want to learn. Give me a shot. That's not so feasible today. So that's changed a lot. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, that's affected the industry in many ways. I think it's stifled that growth. I think it's stifled the ability for somebody to walk in the door and prove themselves as having passion and excitement for this. I understand why we've moved into some of those realms or paths, but not necessarily the best thing in terms of the longevity of this industry and really in terms of shaping people and having people figure out whether or not they want to do it, you know, kind of going off on a tangent. But the amount of people that come out of school and start cooking and they're like, nope, this isn't what I want to do.
Sure.
You probably could have saved, you know, $50,000 and figured this out after a few weeks. So I think that's changed a lot. Again, I think because of the way I was able to start and the fact that you kind of had to show you were hungry and you were really competing against people, I think that gave me this sort of competitive edge. And, you know, I want to learn this. I want to get good at this. You know, Union Square Cafe was a beast of a restaurant. It was busy. As you said, it was kind of this old guard and different, kind of a different dining scene at that point in time in a lot of ways. I learned so much from being there, and I learned more than I ever really understood that I had learned. And it wasn't until years later that I looked back and was, you know, realizing just how educational the time there had been and how much it had done for setting me up for success.
I mean, not only did it set you up for success, but it led to you being at ABC Kitchen, which is when I first had heard of you. And I mean, when ABC opened, it was like, I think a lot of us at the time in the city had never seen a restaurant open up with such fanfare. It's such like hot spot. I mean, it was also like we come out of the recession. Everyone was used to like cheeseburgers and fried chickens. And then here's this new fine dining that was definitely not on the cheaper end of things. But it pushed you into the spotlight. What was it like to be at the helm of that restaurant? Still not yours, but yep. You were front and center. Like you were the guy and you got all these accolades. What was that shift like for you and how you thought your career could be and maybe the extra pressure?
Yeah, I think I had come off of, I mean, if you looked a little bit at the trajectory, I did, you know, 3.5 years at Union Square, learning a little bit, working my way up. Then 7 years at Tabla, working my way up there, really started to understand seasonal cooking, which, you know, probably people wouldn't think of when they think of Indian cuisine, but Floyd was a master of, you know, sort of that devotion to seasonal cooking.
Yeah.
And then through that, met Tom Colicchio. I helped open a private club where that was really the first point in my career, which at that point is, you know, 10, 11 years in, where I said, okay, I truly can do this. Like, you know,
yeah.
I can commit to this. There's a reasonable salary. You know, I'm working my butt off, but sort of paying for itself in the long run. And I have the skills and talent to do this. And then about 4.5 years later, I met Jean-Georges at the market and ended up going to meet with them, not really knowing what to expect. And kind of signed up with them the next day, and it wasn't for ABC Kitchen. It was actually for the Mark Hotel. And so I started at the Mark Hotel. Originally, when we were talking, ABC Kitchen was like this sort of like thought that they had, but it wasn't happening. So I signed on to the Mark because I really wanted to work with Jean-Georges and kind of hone my skills, hone my flavor profile through working with him. Did the Mark Hotel and had helped open some other restaurants around the country with them. And ABC came back to becoming a reality. And they knew that I really liked that farm to table. They knew that I liked that seasonal cooking. And so I moved over there. And you know, I've said this so many times, like you were talking about the fanfare. We didn't expect any of that. Like this was a space that, you know, had been through a few different restaurants.
Sure.
ABC Home was redoing it. And, you know, they were great about, you know, putting their design into it and making it this really cool and sexy space that again was kind of deceiving. It's in the basement or the ground floor of a home goods store.
Sure.
Yes, high end, but like who would have thought that's where high end dining would be? And we just set out to make good food. And I mean, I say that, you know, with all honesty, like we weren't thinking about fanfare. We weren't thinking about it being the best restaurant in the country or anything like that. We just wanted to make good food. And for me, I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to make the seasonal American food. I wanted to hone my skills and put something up to, for Jean-Georges and his corporate chef, Greg Brainin, who's a genius. I wanted them to say, this sucks and this is why, or this is great and this is why. And I wanted to learn that. And so that's all that was, you know, really on my mind. And then obviously as we started open and there was fanfare, it was like, holy shit, like, yeah, there's a lot more pressure now and things are definitely different than what we expected. And, you know, we just rode the waves at that point in time. I mean, we did get very lucky. And I think, you know, it was, I have a friend who, you know, I would say things like that to him. He's like, you made your own luck. I didn't make my own luck. We got lucky. I made, you know, some good choices along the way, but I got very lucky. I've worked hard and that's created some of my fortune, so to speak, but I got lucky. And, you know, ABC is a great example of that. I got lucky in terms of meeting Jean-Georges. I got lucky that it was as popular as it was because, you know, if you look at it, it was just good seasonal American farm to table food. Sure. But as you said, we're coming out of recession, right time, right place, right space.
Yeah.
And we got really lucky.
Amazing. Well, listen, I want to take a quick musical break because I want to talk about sort of the end of your time at ABC and you starting on your own and also how music is playing a big part in your spaces. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
It's okay. Thank you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Chef Dan Kluger. And before we left, you're talking about the sensation that was ABC. And you've proven yourself not just culinary-wise, but I'm going to assume financially. And you have a big pedigree behind you. And a lot of the times when you're working for these chefs who have these big backings of restaurants, they just go like, we're going to give you a space. Like, here you go. You've proven yourself. What do you want to do? We still own it and we still have a say in it, but like, go run this thing like that. You didn't want to do that. You wanted to step out on your own. Why did you want to take that roll of the dice?
Because I think ultimately I wanted to roll the dice, as you said, and put, you know, myself to the task of creating something from start to finish. Mm. I wanted to be the one to say that I wanted this paint color and I wanted this stove and I wanted this pan and mm-hmm. I wanted this mm-hmm. pot and I wanted these plates and this glassware and I wanted this team and this is the kind of wine or whatever it was. And I think, you know, that's a very, it's a very invigorating task. It's a very challenging one. I think it's, you know, it becomes very rewarding when things kind of work out in that respect. But it's just a, you know, it's a hard task. And so I think I was really fortunate enough to have done some of that, at ABC and ABC Cocina, but you know, it was never going to be mine and I didn't want it to be mine. That was their restaurant and there's right. only so much that I should, be able to do just like, you know, I have a team of people that probably in the same boat that at some point they're going to want to do their own thing and they want to use this pan or they want that plate or whatever it is. And this is the farmer they want to use. So that's why people do kind of move on. But I think, you know, it was the right time for me personally to go out and put myself to that task.
When you were on the road to opening up your first spot, which would become Loring Place, you sound so confident now with the decision in this moment. I'm talking with you because it's open, it's successful, things like that. Any time in between you leaving ABC and the opening of those doors where you're like, maybe I should not have done this?
No, I'd say that's more my mindset today. I think I was so motivated and inspired by the process that there really wasn't a doubt. I mean, there was frustrations and there was kind of like, you know, when can I get back to cooking kind of doubt or, you know, sort of like, I wish I hadn't have left because I missed this. But I liked the process. I liked learning about real estate and you know, the deals and pushing myself to learn more about the finances. So no real regret or pause for concern in that respect. I think today I often look at it as like, you know, I wish in some respects, not that I didn't do this, but that essentially that I was back working with somebody that I could lean on for support and rely on for that overarching support that you get from, you know, a group, whether you know, Jean-Georges, Danny Meyer or right. whoever. But, you know, there is something to be said in terms of all the little things that you don't think of that you don't think of in a right. restaurant. Right. And people take for granted that, you know, of course the garbage is going to get picked up. Of course the linen company is going to show up. Of course the bills are going to be paid. And it's not about money or those things. It's somebody like pressing a button or somebody making a phone call or whatever. That it becomes a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's all the small things which can add up to large things. I remember my friend telling me about how the manager of the restaurant I worked at didn't think about breaking down cardboard. And so they filled up the basement with cardboard that wasn't broken down. That means they couldn't take inventory for deliveries. And it's just like, it's all because of the cardboard. So those are the small things. But obviously when you're going into opening up your own spot, there's got to be so much excitement about like the vibe and the menu and then also the music, which is, I know, a part of it. So did you have that in mind? And how much did like the landscape of New York and you being from there inspire that? Did you want to open up like a classic New York spot that was farm to table? You know, what was on your mind when you were going into your very first spot?
I don't know if you call any of it classic New York, because I'm not quite sure I even know what that is today. I think it was classic in this sort of farm to table sense, but I think that also, I don't know what it is today. It's become overused as a term.
Well, what about when you were opening though? Like, cause yes,
I'm saying even when
even
I was
then.
Opening,
oh, okay. Yeah.
I feel like when I had left ABC, you know, every restaurant was a farm to table restaurant.
Fair.
And not necessarily truly a farm to table restaurant. So I think I was actually, in a lot of sense, I was kind of wrestling with what that identity was, right? Because I didn't love that we were being referred to as farm to table. And I didn't love that, you know, everything was Dan Kluger, ABC Kitchen or whatever, right? Like I wanted this to be different. And I think, you know, it's similar in that it is farm to table. It's American seasonal, but I think, you know, very, very different menus and slightly different styles. I think for me in creating the menu, I relied a lot on my 20 or so years of cooking, and not that I wanted to do a dish from one of the previous restaurants, but I wanted to do a dish that was inspired by it. And so I drew from all these different places, and I thought about, you know, whether it was something that I had done at ABC and how was that going to play a place on the menu. And I, like something like the kabocha toast we had done at ABC, and everybody loved the kabocha toast. As soon as it was kabocha season, everybody would come in and ask for it, right? And I was like, I don't want to do toast anymore. I'm over the toast. But I love kabocha. I love kind of what that had become. Mm-hmm. We had a whole like dips and spread section. So we did a baked ricotta with kabocha. It was inspired by that. It was a nod to that. There was a duck dish that was on the opening menu that was like, you know, a nod to my time with Floyd at Tabla, in that it had this chutney with it. And then it was a nod to, you know, time with Jean-Georges, and that it just had some braised greens with it. Like, you know, that was something that he wasn't afraid to do in terms of like, it's a great protein and here's just a simple vegetable. We don't need to do a whole lot to it.
Right.
And then, you know, just the using a wood burning grill to make it, or how we cooked it, again, a little bit of a nod to past and present, I guess, restaurants that I'd worked at. So that's, I think, how New York played a big part in it. We tried to focus on local purveyors where we could, you know, or local builders and designers. The plates were from John Pandolfi, who everybody knows at this point, who's local. A lot of the furniture was made like Jersey, Brooklyn area. A lot of the furniture was actually made from beams that we'd taken out of the restaurant. So it's like the metalwork was a place in Brooklyn. Like we really tried to at least focus on how do we make this New York in that respect, right? Because to me, that's a big part of New York, is that we're kind of leaning on each other and building from within.
No, I love that. And it's this whole idea of like recycling and repurposing New York, which is just like, if you spend any time there, you're like, oh, that was this thing, and now this is something else. And it was a church and then a nightclub and, you know, all that. So I know you opened up Washington Squares, and I don't want to jump ahead too far, but when did you start thinking about Grey Wind and opening up a second place in the city? You know, it's such a, and I know it's a different era now, but it used to be like one chef, one restaurant. This is what it is. And obviously then you had restaurant groups and things like that, but now it really is expected. Like once you get a successful restaurant, there needs to be like second one, third one, you know, bakery, bar, and you've done all those things. What made you feel that you were ready to really open up another spot?
I don't know if it's ready or, and I would almost say it's not so much about being expected as not having a choice, meaning, you know, financially, you need more. Like the restaurants don't make money, right? So if you're going to survive, you essentially need to have a few restaurants. You need to spread some of that labor and executive management, that kind of stuff, and some of the basic costs across a few things. So I think that's a big part of it. And again, I really love I love the whole process behind building and designing. And so, Washington Squares was not a new restaurant. Washington Squares was, something we created out of Loring Place as a need to get through the pandemic. But, during or before the pandemic, we had started on a restaurant in Long Island City called Penny Bridge. Mm-hmm. And then in the heat of the pandemic, we were sort of in construction, and then we opened it, while still in the pandemic, going through, you know, zero indoor seating and all sorts of things. And we were just open for it to go. And then we closed that and put it on pause for a while. And we came back and it just never took off. And, you know, it's sad because to me, that was that second restaurant. That was that challenge. Like, right. So, you know, when we talk about Grey Wind, that's really number three. Not that it's any easier, but it's like, okay, I've gone through this process of having a restaurant while doing meetings and designing one and thinking about the team and all that kind of stuff. So that really gave me the confidence to do more. Unfortunately, while giving me confidence, breaking the confidence when it failed. But I think when you talk about New York, and playing a part, I think for me, that one was really special because we designed it as this really cool kind of modern space. It had, you know, 30-foot ceilings, all glass, huge cement columns. It was a gorgeous space and it was designed really well. But I kind of came up with the food concept after the design. I don't know that I would have changed much, but the concept was sort of based on comfort food and classic New York diners and things like that. And so it kind of had to play a part in that within a modern setting. And so we talked a lot and thought a lot about how that fit. And I kind of looked at everything and broke it down as, you know, what's a classic dish and then what's our rendition of it and how does that fit in this modern scape? And so sometimes that was, you know, just trying to be best in class, whether it was something like our mozzarella sticks were insane. And to me, they were best in class and that's all we wanted to do. And it was, you know, mozzarella sticks with tomato sauce, but it was a lot more than that.
Sure.
But
of course.
It wasn't like deconstructed. If you looked at it, it was a mozzarella stick, right? But then we would take something else, like meatloaf. And that's always one of my favorite examples of like, we took something that was meatloaf and it inspired a dish that was actually a slow roasted chuck. And it had spinach. It had all these things, right. That were somewhat resemblance of a meatloaf that I grew up with as a comfort food for me, but this had nothing to do with it. It was inspired by that. And so I think the reason why I kind of tell this whole story is because as we talk about music playing a part, music was a really big part of that restaurant in that, everything kind of came together as, you know, something that inspired something else. So I grew up in the city. I grew up DJing. I loved music. I DJed for through college and for about 5 or 6 years afterwards on Saturday nights just to help pay the bills. And so I loved old school hip hop and I loved R&B. And I what I loved was like figuring out what a sample was and how to incorporate that sample. And so we kind of applied that same thing to the food and then in this case, the music, right? Like what's a sample. So the nachos, exactly. Like what's the meatloaf sample, right? So it was a basic meatloaf, but we remixed it, right? We did our thing to it. And so food wise and music wise, it was really the same thing. Like the music, the original music playlist was very much like all music that had been sampled into today's hip hop. So that's how that like really plays a part in things for me.
Yeah. You know, you have two restaurants, you've got the bar, you've got the bakery, you have woven yourself into the fabric of New York life. And so now as you go around the city, how do you feel about your place in it from when you were a kid, going to Chinatown, going to Fairway Market, things like that? Like you've now planted your flag outside of your home into these like public spaces. What does it mean to you? How do you look at it?
I mean, I think it's all just another step in the career. It's exciting to have been able to open Grey Wind and Spy Gold and the Bakery at Grey Wind, all in Hudson Yards, which is not far from where I grew up at all. Mm-hmm. That area has changed completely.
Uh-huh.
Talk about a remix.
Yes. Talk about a sample. Yeah.
And so I think in terms of fabric, again, you know, we just were pulling from childhood memories of you know, nostalgic food, whether it's something that's New York or not. I think the team involved is you know, very diverse, and so I think we're pulling from a lot of different areas. But we're thinking about what did we grow up with, what was exciting to us, or where did we travel to recently? And so we're always trying to find some inspiration with something that is very sort of like a common thread to all of us. You might have traveled to Japan. I might have traveled to England, but what did we see in those travels, and how does that then essentially become a dish? And through that, I think we just keep tying back to, you know, local and seasonal and New York in terms of, you know, being part of the fabric. I don't think it's, you know, changed a whole lot for me in the past, I don't know, 15, 20 years of doing this, even more. But you know, I feel just as excited today about, you know, this project as Loring Place when it was opening in 2014.
Amazing. Well, Chef, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. If people want to check out any of your spots or see what you're up to, follow along, maybe which fresh produce you're grabbing from your favorite market, where can they go online, social media?
You can go to at Dan Kluger. You can go to at Loring Place, at Grey Wind, at Spy Gold, at the Bakery of Grey Wind, at Washington Squares. I have a cookbook out called Chasing Flavor. So there's a lot of places you can find me.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad we found you here on the show today. Thank you to Ella and Mona, as always, for helping to set this up. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Snacky Tunes. We are at the legendary Dangerbird Record Studios in gorgeous Silver Lake. It's always gorgeous because we're in California, and we have one of California's born and bred, Matt Costa. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for having me.
Raised here, lived here,
mm-hmm.
Never leaving.
I've moved to other places, but I was born actually right down the street at what's the Dream Center there off the 101 in Rampart.
Were you born in the Dream Center?
I was born in the Dream Center, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Was your family part of the Dream Center?
No, at the time it was a hospital, like a normal hospital. I don't know what the Dream Center is now, but at the time it was a...
Yeah.
It was called like Mary Queen of the Angels Hospital.
For those who don't know the Dream Center is, it is a nebulous sort of place where groups of men in black t-shirts will walk around and clean up Silver Lake.
Okay,
but
yeah.
I don't know what else they do.
Yeah.
I don't know. So born and bred LA. Do you find that like being from LA, living in LA has influenced your entire music career, writing approach to being an artist?
Well, I grew up in Orange County, so Huntington Beach and mm-hmm. in that area. So, you know, just outside of it. But I think just living in California in general, especially on this record, it's been, with geographically and those things it's come out. And I grew up skateboarding and stuff too. And so just being here, in one of the meccas for skateboarding, that influenced my music a lot too, just the music and videos and stuff.
What about the videos? What about the visual artistic of skateboarding videos? Because this is, would you like, what, 90s skateboarding videos?
Yeah.
So, and what do you bring to that and that aesthetic? Because that's a very, like, OC skate videos are a very niche type of approach to making art.
Yeah. I mean, because of that, it was like, there was a lot, though. You know, there was a lot of the kind of, I would watch like girl skate videos and stuff like that, ooh, where they're SF and yeah, also, yeah. And also in LA here and all the World Industries and Blind videos and stuff like that, where they'd skate LA a lot. And also the music in those was really cool. I got turned on to that was the first time I remember like you'd hear stuff on the radio and things like that, but especially like in my parents' car or something. But then I listened to, it was like Van Morrison's song Caravan in the FTC video. And I thought, all of a sudden, Van Morrison was cool, you know?
Right. It's I felt like that those 90s skate videos were such a great postmodern approach to making art, because you would have these like amazing songs, but when these like young kids just ripping.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would just create this whole new type of like piece to enjoy.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And to show it, I guess, as an artist would show that sort of you could bring in all influences to what you wanted to create without having to feel that like you had to leave stuff off the table because it wasn't cool or not cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, it just was, you know, there was all, you know, obviously there's all sorts of stuff. There's, you know, obviously like there's Misfits and Danzig and stuff like that. And
yeah.
I mean, stuff too.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
I mean, which I like, I listened to that as well, but then there was also, there was a lot of hip hop and soul. And then there was a lot of the classic stuff and it didn't really matter. So when it was in there and then it was associated with the visual, then I was hooked, you know?
So you started getting it. When did you first start writing music? I know you've been doing professionally off and on for about, I mean, not off and on, but on for about 15 years. But yeah. When did you start to dabble? Younger, when you were skateboarding, or when you were a little bit older?
Yeah, no, I just played music then. And I didn't really play that often. I just played guitar and a little bit and trumpet and stuff like that in school band. But when I was 19 or so trying to write, just like really digging into songs more, like studying whatever, just like learning whole songs and thinking about lyrics and those kind of things.
Was there a shift? Do you remember a moment when you went, I'm going to go after this as something I want to do with my life? Or was it just a natural progression?
Yeah, it was just a natural progression for me. I mean, I broke my leg skateboarding really bad. Mm. And a lot of my friends at the time, you know, we're all getting sponsored and, you know, they were all kind of, some of them were already going pro and things like that. And then that's what I wanted to do. But then I broke my leg and I thought I'd be back in like 3 months or something and keep going. But then it ended up being about a year and 2 years. And by the end of that, I really had to train myself to walk again. And so riding a skateboard, going down big handrails and stuff like that and doing the things that I wanted to do was seemed really out of the question, at least for the time being. And during those two years and 3 years of like basically recovery, it's still, even now, it's not fully back. I guess I could have done better physical therapy and things.
Yeah.
But that's when I started writing songs. And then within 4 years, and I kind of started doing shows and had some people who were like, you know, I just had released some things and people were, you know, excited about it, friends of mine. And then just I just kind of kept going with that. But it never was like, I want to do this for a career. It was more just sort of like, I like music and I just want to try it out.
I mean, seeing how you've had a pretty good run as a musician.
Yeah.
Do you find that moment where your life sort of diverged with that accident as something that you look back on like this, I'm happy this happened now? Or do you see it as something where you're like, you found a way to channel like what happened to you into something that making what your life is today?
Yeah, I think all that stuff, the development when I was a kid to skateboarding is just like, just shifted into songwriting. Same sort of discipline and same sort of...
It's a lot of discipline, like getting up, doing that trick over and over and again. So applying that to music is a great way to be like, I want to get this chord, I want to hit this timing, right?
Totally, yeah. And I think also too, but there's things that I did want to like, that I did want to do different. Because I remember that when I was young, it was all just like muscling things and going.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started writing music, then I realized that, you know, you can sit and learn, you know, and I still do, you'll learn scales and you got to learn all the kind of fundamentals of it.
Sure.
But I realized that, you know, not muscling, you can muscle a guitar part or a song or something like that, but right. You have to like, it gets more, you know, introspective and you have to be more thoughtful with it. And that's when the best stuff comes out. So when skateboarding, I did that, I saw some people who put that approach in skateboarding and they were always better, you know? And right. Then it took me to like stepping away from it to see that. And then I started applying that to my, or I've always tried to apply that to my music because I just know that it makes, at least I think it makes for better art.
Well, speaking of better art, let's hear a song.
All right. I'll try to play a good one here.
Oh, you're going to play a great one. What do you got for us?
Let's see here. This one is a song called Pacific Grove. And I found this drum machine here, so I figured I'd use it.
Awesome.
I know you've been away for a long time. Feels like 10 years or more. Got me to thinking I shouldn't have said all those things I regret even more now. I'm feeling sentimental. Times I'm living for the past. Hold your face before my eyes, but it never seems to last. So let's go back to Pacific Grove when those monarchs come back home. I know I won't make it alone. We'll love and laugh in a tavern when that evening sun goes down and meet halfway in Pacific Grove. At times my mind did wander like a bird from limb to limb. Wake up early, but who am I fooling? There's no one next to me. And there on the misty street is that neon light we know. Often I've longed for your silhouette glowing inside that window. So let's go back to Pacific Grove when those monarchs come back home. I know I won't make it alone. We'll love and laugh in a tavern when that evening sun goes down and meet halfway in Pacific Grove. Pacific Grove. Like 10 years or more. got me to thinking I shouldn't have said those things I regret even more now. So let's go back to Pacific Grove when those monarchs come back home. I know I won't make it alone. With love and laughing and jiving when that evening sun goes down, and eat halfway in Pacific Grove. We'll meet halfway in Pacific Grove. Pacific Grove.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Sweet. That's a great one.
Thanks, man.
Better than a good one.
All right, cool. I'll take
so
that.
After you started playing for a few years and you started putting stuff out, when did you feel both like that your career had started and then you were also starting to hit the stride of the music that you wanted to make? Instead of muscling through, that you were like finessing and like curating the songs you were writing.
Yeah. Well, I kind of always thought about, I tried to write songs that I would have to grow into or something. I mean, I'd write ideas in order to push myself to like become them, you know, in that sort of sense.
I like that.
And then,
but you got to man up to the songs you wrote
a little bit. Yeah. And then a lot, you know, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you're not ready for it. It takes, you have to put them away and then you come back to them. But
can you give me an example?
Well, let's think about that. Well, on my first record, let's see here. On my first record, there was some finger picking songs, and there was some, and there was also some electric guitar stuff, and I felt, I mean, those took a while to write and create. It was like about a 2 or 3 year sort of process.
Gotcha.
So during that time, I had ideas, and I'd be developing them, so for when I did a record called Mobile Chateau, which was my third record. That's the first one that I self-produced.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the songs that were on that, I'd had the ideas for a little while, but I just didn't have the right production techniques or different things that I needed to even like hear them back the way that I needed to perform them.
Yeah.
And so also spending a couple years or two records on the road, traveling and doing things, then you understand, you know, just how stuff works in a live situation versus studio situation, all those things.
Does that matter to you as, I mean, especially with the new art, the new album, Santa Rosa Fangs, where it's like a concept album straight to finish that's telling us narrative. So obviously there are things you're thinking about there, studio application and then live application.
Yeah. Well, when I did this record, I worked it up with my friend Peter Matthew Bauer and Nick Stumpf. And I think the goal the whole time was to write songs that would just be deliverable really strong live,
mm-hmm.
to where I could go out there with my band and just have them be really impactful.
Mm.
Even more so than other songs where, you know, you're missing the like three guitar parts that are like weaving together or something.
Right, right.
When you just have, you know, when you don't have all those things, and a lot of times that's fine, you know, but when you have the idea, you want to deliver it in its entirety. So these ones, for the most part, there was, you know, there it was, they worked, and probably some of the best songs I think live, as far as really having a punch to them.
Yeah,
I feel that at least when I play them on this tour, and that feels really good because after doing so many records, to still feel that way, it's a great feeling.
Do you feel that you pull a little of the punch when you're recording it so that when it comes out live, people are like, whoa, this is a whole other experience? Or do you try and pour as much into recording it as you do into the live show?
I think the recording stuff is more just like, it's different because you can, you know, it's really hard to capture the immensity of something on a recording. So you have to capture it. It's more of like, I think recordings a lot of times are, they're all like your perception of the way it's sonic perception of it, you know? So if you, just because you play in a room really big and really loud, you can mic it up, doesn't mean it's going to sound really big and loud.
Sure.
So, I mean, sometimes you have to make things really small in order to, like, you know, a vocal or something, things like that, have it sit in the mix where everything else sounds huge, but it's just perspective and of how the track sounds, you know, audio illusion sort of thing. And then performance is key, you know, as far as that as well. So I think you perform it good, but, yeah, those studio things are a little different than just when you go live. When you go live, you just want to get in there and, like, you know, you can fill up a room with the sound, and that's, you can't ever recreate that on a record, I don't think so. And also the actual physical vibrations that you're getting from it.
Oh, the physical feeling of it. Yeah. I love that when you're in a room and you can feel the music, like, in your body.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. Can we hear another song?
Sure, yeah.
What do you got for us?
This one is a song called Sharon. And I'll tell you a story about it. When I wrote this song years and years ago, before I'd written this song, I was sitting with a friend of mine, and she came over to my house. Her name's Liz. She's married to my drummer now. And at the time, she had a shaved head, and I thought I thought she was pretty cool. Yeah. And she was playing banjo. And then I sat down. I had my guitar, and I was talking to her. And I said, I have this weird, like, tic that keeps going on, like, circling in my brain, sort of like Oliver Sacks sort of thing. And then I hadn't read any of that then. So I just thought I was going crazy. And it was sort of ran. It was just when I stopped playing music, I stopped doing anything. Whatever happened, I had this, you know, hamster wheel of a sound that was going on in my mind. Ran. And then years went by. Well, before that, she had told me, she's like, you should put it in a song. And I was like, well, ran. It doesn't make sense. You know, I don't, like, ran. I don't know. It took me a long time to try to make something work. And I sat down again years later, and it turned into, like, Duran, or something like that. I was like, this is dumb. And then I sat down to do this record. I'd written one song. I remember it well, was the first song. And then when I went down to write the second song, I started playing my guitar again. I started going, Duran, but Sharon. And it turned into Sharon. And so Sharon revealed herself to me. And then I made her the centerpiece for the record. And so that's how that came about.
It's amazing.
That's one of those ones, like, you know, I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, how, is that you, like, will yourself, you man up, you will yourself into a song that's in your...
A sound that for years and years was just, like, phonetically it sounded nice in my head, but I had no idea what it was, and then it turned into something years later.
Amazing. So that we're going to hear right now?
Yeah, this is Sharon.
All right, here we go.
She's going out tonight. See her aquarium friends. Amongst the buffoons and the bogarts. She's strung out again. She knows not what she does. She knows not how she feels. She don't know if she's living or dying. Her bucket's full of pills. And she's colder than the coast of Maine. Sharon on a snowy winter's day. Sharon, she cut you like she cut me. Sharon, it's a new region on the sea. Sharon, 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 Sharon. You know I've seen you make arrangements with all the lawyers at the bar. I know you're going through those changes. Yeah, I know you're going through those changes. And I've seen you going through those changes. Gone, gone, gone. And still your daddy pays your rent. She knows now what she does. She knows not how she feels. She don't know if she's living or dying. Her bucket's full of pills. And she's colder than the coast of Maine. Sharon on a snowy winter's day. Sharon, she cuts you like she cut me. Sharon, and send you raging on mercy. Sharon, 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 Sharon.
Awesome.
All right.
Good tune.
Thanks, man.
Good rhythm. So do you feel now that you've gotten that tune out of your head, does it feel better that you can share it with people instead of just having it go around in your brain?
Yeah. That's why it's called Sharon.
So Sharon is the central character in your new album.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept album. Beautiful story. How did it come about? What made you want to do like a whole narrative throughout your whole album?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the stories come from my life or people who I know, and I've kind of tied them all together into sort of her and me sort of narrating it. And I imagined it like with this, seeing the movie before I'd actually made the record or made the movie. And so as, I thought about kind of these songs sort of, being the score for it. And I'd come off the heels of doing a soundtrack to a documentary called Orange Sunshine.
Yeah.
And so I was really, I was in the mode of working with visuals and creating things that were, hand in hand, together. They worked symbiotically. So I just, I took that same concept and decided to make this record. And then as it's gone on, then the story is like revealed more, and I think eventually I'll turn it into writing a screenplay to it now. So kind of doing it reverse.
That's awesome. It sort of ties back to the skate videos and the music. And
it does, yeah.
Tying it all together, the songs and the video and things like that.
It does. I think that when I was a kid, I mean, I wouldn't make my own music for them when I started, but you know, I'd find my own records that I liked, and then I'd get the CD player, the cassette player, and then my VHS player, and I'd put the audio into it, and then I'd get another VHS player, and then dub it over and make my own skate videos. That's how you make your sponsor me videos.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, and so now you're just doing it in reverse.
I guess so. Yeah.
And so with the new album, it's a very California album. Like,
yeah.
Do you feel that you've let your Californian like pride and heritage really shine through on this? And do you feel that there's a unique story that you're telling about California that you have that maybe the world doesn't know, you know, because a lot of times when people think of California, they think of like very specific,
yeah,
maybe like a Hollywood story or a San Francisco story or like, hiking through the woods in the north.
Uh-huh.
Are you telling a different type of California story?
Well, I mean, I'm just speaking from my own experience and people that I've known, but I think it's not, it is California, because this is where I'm from and some of the cities that I name and things like that. But I also think that it can be, you know, it's sort of that place and those memories can exist anywhere. You know, mine just happens to be in California, and there's the cities that come of it. And I grew up here. So that's my story. But the funny thing is that, the record before this record, I went to Scotland and I recorded over there. And I'd grown up listening to a lot of like British folk music, and I'd listened to a lot of like Brit pop music.
Mm.
And so I had these ideas of going and recording up in like Scotland and the Highlands or something, and these like this music. I ended up being in Glasgow and I'd recorded with some of the members of Belle and Sebastian, who I was a big fan of their music. Yeah, I love them too. So it was by no means a traditional Scottish folk record. It was, and I'm happy for that, because that's not the kind of record I wanted to make. But I did slide a little bit of those influences in there here and there. But when I was there, I was talking with Stevie Jackson, and he played guitar on it, and we became close friends. But he was more, you know, into romanticizing the other side of the pond. He was just talking about Graceland and told me more about Elvis than I knew from being over here.
Right.
And then I was more into like talking about like going to like the apartment where Sandy Denny lived and Incredible String Band and things like that.
Yeah.
And so, but for that reason, I do know a lot of traditional Scottish songs. I could play you one of those if you want.
I mean, if you want to end on that, we can.
I can, yeah.
That. But before we end on that, you know, now that you have the album, now that you have this big story, do these characters continue beyond this album? Is it something that you've now brought these people to life through your music and, you know, hopefully through screenplay, things like that? Like, how do you live with these characters that you create? Do you feel responsible for them to see their lives through? Or is it just like, here's a moment in time where you've opened a window into their world and then you're moving on to look into something else?
Yeah. No, I think that they'll definitely stick around for a while. I mean, the thing was, is that, yeah, it's like I've opened the door to them and now they're in the room. So, but the interesting thing was, you know, about telling a California story, and within Sharon and within the whole thing, there's a lot of people that I know that are close, and myself as well, that are inside of these songs. But it took going to, across the sea to come home and really appreciate and write a California record. And so sometimes when I sit there in the hills, I still play my Scottish songs when the mist rolls in just to mess with people.
Yeah, that the marine layer is a good inspiration. Before we go, where can people find your music online? Where can people find you, keep up on your tour and your travels?
Yeah, they can just go to, I have Instagram, Matt Costa Music.
Yeah.
And then they can go to my website, mattcosta.com.
Awesome.
And, yeah, I think those are the main ones. I have Facebook and that kind of stuff too. So
whatever, yeah.
It all links together.
Yeah. Well, Matt, thank you so much.
Cool.
Congratulations on the tour, on the new album. Good luck on the screenplay.
Thank you.
And what are you gonna take us out with?
I'm gonna leave you with a California take on a bagpipe tune.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thank you so much to Gingerbird Records.
Yeah.
Studios. We'll see you next time on Snacky Tunes. Matt, take it away.
Sweet. Yeah, this one's called Banish Misfortune.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
tribe.